WFAE is proud to launch She Says, a new investigative podcast about sexual assault told by someone who's living it. Find the first episode of She Says now on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/She Says.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Coming up, one of the most important people in Charlotte. But first, we get a preview of some interesting primary races coming up tomorrow in South Carolina. The race for governor there could be the most expensive statewide race in South Carolina history. Together, the eight Democratic and Republican candidates have raised more than $14 million, and the candidates in the Palmetto State's 5th Congressional District race are getting some attention for things outside of politics. Winthrop University professor of political science and founder and director of Winthrop's Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory, Scott Huffman, takes us through those races right now. Welcome back to the program.
My pleasure.
Good to see you. Now, how unusual is it for there to be so many people in the gubernatorial race, particularly when one of them is the incumbent?
Now, that is pretty uncommon, because usually when you have this many in a primary, there's no incumbent. But, of course, this is a unique situation. Henry McMaster was sort of elevated to the position thanks to his buddy Donald Trump, who named Nikki Haley as UN ambassador. Now, McMaster was in a four-way race back in 2010 for the gubernatorial primary against Nikki Haley. In fact, he was the front runner of that one until Sarah Palin came down and endorsed Nikki Haley in that race.
In April, McMaster had the backing, I think, of 46% of the state's GOP voters. Now he has, 37%? Is that right?
Yeah, this race has really changed a lot, especially in the last 2 weeks. Up until probably last week, I would have said the odds are it's going to be a runoff between Henry McMaster and Catherine Templeton. But John Warren has surged amazingly, and now I'd say it's an even bet as to whether Warren or Templeton make the runoff against Henry McMaster.
Last week polls, these numbers could be wrong because you have more current numbers than I have, but they showed Catherine Templeton had the support of 25% of Republican voters, and John Warren, who's a first-time candidate, had 20%. On his side.
Right, but he went from 1%
wow.
to 20%.
Why?
Over the course of, well, I think it's the people who were mainly undecided and they were looking for an alternative to Henry McMaster, and Henry McMaster and Catherine Templeton are fishing in the same ponds. So, they're going after the same type of voter. So somebody looking for an alternative to that is beginning to turn to John Warren, and with the margin of error on that poll, remember, for each point, the 25 could go up or down 5 points, the 20 could go up or down 5 points. So they could be reversed with John Warren a little bit ahead, or they could be further apart.
Well, John Warren, I said at the beginning that the $14 million has been spent in this gubernatorial campaign by the Democrats and the Republicans, but John Warren has raised, well, he didn't raise it. He put in $3 million of his own money.
Own money. So, yeah, a huge chunk of that.
What does he do? And why does he want to be governor?
Well, banks. He's mortgage. He's a lender. He comes from a Marine background. He is actually the closest thing to an outsider in the race, although Catherine Templeton tries to claim that mantle. He really wants to be governor, apparently, and he's done a great job of running from absolutely no name recognition to now possibly making a runoff.
There are actually five Republicans running for governor. The three we've mentioned, McMaster, Templeton, and Warren, but there are two others. Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryan is a distant fourth with only 5% support, and former Lieutenant Governor Yancey McGill is dead last with 3% of support. How unusual is it for the Lieutenant Governor to run against the incumbent governor?
Well,
that doesn't make for good discussion behind
this
the scenes.
This is actually the first race in South Carolina history where the lieutenant governor and the governor are going to be running together. So before, they were completely separate races.
Okay.
So, you ran and became lieutenant governor, or you ran and became governor. But in this case, remember, they didn't run together. They didn't run in the same election. They both got elevated when Nikki Haley went up, because when the lieutenant governor went up to governor, they needed to bring somebody to be lieutenant governor up from the legislature. So they represent technically different wings within the party.
So you mentioned that...
Oh, and Yancey McGill's a former Democrat, so he's not going to get more than 3% anyway.
You mentioned that Henry McMaster and Catherine Templeton are fishing in the same pond. What does that mean?
Well, they both are trying to claim the mantle of Trump and Nikki Haley, heir to Nikki Haley and the Trump mantle. You know, Catherine Templeton was the head of two governmental agencies and got the nickname Buzzsaw for how many people she would fire while she was the head of Department of, Health and Environmental Control or Labor Licensing. And Henry McMaster was the first South Carolina politico to endorse Trump. So Trump has actually
endorsed him
in a tweet. But Catherine Templeton says, well, that's political payback, but I'm the real Trump-like candidate. And they've had these incredible ads coming out, a lot of them with falsehoods. Catherine Templeton shooting a rattlesnake. They've been really amazing. But they're both trying to claim the mantle of Nikki Haley as well because – you know, Catherine Templeton was appointed by Nikki Haley, and Henry McMaster was her lieutenant governor.
Who is John Warren? He's a first-time candidate. He's a former Marine, obviously a business guy, because he's got $3 million of his own money to put into the campaign. What's he running on? If he's not running on Trump and Nikki Haley, what's he running on?
Well, he is doing I'm the real outsider here. I know how to get things done. The classic businessman. he is a lender from the upstate, which is politically important because Kevin Bryant's trying to get the upstate religious folks too. The religious folks are more in the upstate, but he's got a lot of support there. He is a former Marine. He's, you know, saying I can come in and run it like a business, which of course in South Carolina you can't. We're a legislatively dominant state. They're trying to slowly change that, but that's from the Constitution of 1895. So you actually cannot come in and run it like a businessman, but man, voters love to hear that.
Yes, they do. Catherine Templeton's numbers, at least the latest numbers, reveal a slight edge over Henry McMaster among male voters. I think did I write this down right? 3 to 29%? That can't be right. But while McMaster has a slight lead over Templeton among all voters, what is Templeton's appeal to male voters?
Well, you know, and I've done some research on the appeal of minority candidates, for example, to those who are the most racially conservative. And one of the things is they're the exception. So if you're racially conservative, but you see a minority who's embracing your ideas, you say, oh, well, see, that's how they, the universal they, should be. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of that here as well. Henry McMaster is the classic good old boy. He's been in this forever. He's always coveted the governor's race. And, Catherine Templeton, two people who don't follow politics closely, knowing that she's been in it for a while, seems like a fresh face.
Henry McMaster, the governor, at least in one debate, tried to paint Catherine Templeton as a serial liar and John Warren as an inexperienced newcomer. Templeton and Warren have said McMaster is a crony of corrupt politicians and consultants, and both are fighting each other as to who is the true conservative in the race. Is this what GOP voters want them to be talking about?
Well, you know, there's always what's called the two constituencies problem. The one constituency is your primary constituency, and if you're a Republican, you have to run as far right as possible, a Democrat further left in states other than South Carolina. And so, yes, they're wanting to say, who's the true conservative? And so when you basically are espousing all the same platform points publicly, they all say they're, you know, against abortion under all circumstances, you know, everything is basically the same. You have to find something to stand out. I'm the true conservative. They've lied about it in the past. Catherine Templeton mentioned she voted for a Democrat as governor one time, and you know that's trying to be held against her. Henry McMaster is connected to the Quinns, the family of political consultants, who are in the process of being arrested, prosecuted, and several of them convicted for corruption. So that's the tie-in there.
Okay. In other Republican races around the country, many of the successful candidates have put some separation between themselves and President Trump. And as you said earlier, in this instance, I think with Templeton and McMaster, they are trying to out-Trump the other. How does that play in South Carolina? And if you have five Republicans in the race, Are they all trying to be Trumpies, except for, I can't think of his name right now, John Warren, rather? Are they all trying to be Trumpies?
No, not really. You know, the Trump voters and the Trump supporters are out there, and you need to get a majority to avoid a runoff, but a plurality to make it into the runoff as the front runner. And so who's the Trumpiest trumpeter on the Trump train is going to absolutely get a subset of voters. Kevin Bryant's basically saying, I am the religious conservative here. He is the farthest right religious. Yancey McGill is, I can get things done. I know this. I know how to work across the aisle. He's not going to get anywhere because he was once a Democrat. But the people who actually show up in the Republican primary are the most committed. So if you're saying, how do I win over the most passionate party members, then in South Carolina, where Trump's popularity is still very high among Republicans, that's the thing to go. It's Trump's popularity in South Carolina among the general population is a couple of points higher than nationally. So not that great, but it's above 80 with self-identified
Republicans. So what role will Donald Trump's endorsement of Henry McMaster play in this? Will that be the gold seal of approval, therefore we'll vote for him?
No, it's just a reminder. Everybody knew that Trump was going to support Henry McMaster because Henry McMaster supported Trump. This is a last-minute reminder as folks go in.
Because President Trump, according to, I think, the Winthrop poll, has an 81% approval rating in South Carolina among Republicans.
Among Republicans.
46% overall, which is a considerable. But given that, how have Democratic candidates in this race, in the Democratic primary race for governor, been treating or talking about the president?
Well, the exact opposite, of course, because that's what motivates Democrats right now is, oh my God, we've got to do something about this president. And so all of them have been saying, we've got to get rid of Trump as a talking point. And among the governor's race, Phil Noble is painting himself as the Bernie Sanders candidate, and he's probably been saying it more than any. But frontrunner James Smith on the Democratic side is anti-Trump as well. All of them have been trying to use that to motivate Democratic voters like we've seen in North Carolina and places all around the country.
So the three Democratic candidates in the Democratic primary are Margaret Willis. She has been critical of Trump's budget. Charleston businessman Phil Noble points to rising health care costs due to the GOP opposition to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And as you mentioned, State Representative James Smith of Columbia has sought to, I think, galvanize Democrats by mentioning Trump's support of Henry McMaster. So do the numbers here. If President Trump has a 46% overall rating among all South Carolinians, does a Democrat have a shot in the general election?
Right this election, a Democrat has the best shot that they've had since the turn of the century, to be honest.
Maybe 2000, not 1900.
Right. Yeah. You got to remember what century we're in. And so that doesn't mean it's great. You got to remember, if I say, hey, there's a 30% chance of rain and it doesn't rain, it's not that I was wrong. It's just that probability didn't hit. So this is the best chance a Democrat has had in a long time, but that doesn't mean that they're not still behind. The Republican, whoever it is, will go into this a neutral 10-point favorite, and then we'll see during the campaign.
Why does Phil Noble, the Democrat, have the lead in that race?
Phil Noble?
James Smith.
James Smith,
why does he have the
James Smith was – a lot of folks wanted him to run as the Democratic nominee last time. Mm-hmm. But, there are folks that said, the guy who ran in 2010 only lost by 4 points. Maybe he can do it again. But James Smith, Afghan vet, supported by Joe Biden, 22 years in the State House. They think he's got the best chance.
Scott Huffman is here. He's the founder and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory and the Winthrop Poll at Winthrop University. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. On this week's FAQ City, listener Margaret Peoples has lingering questions about a 2016 report in the Charlotte Observer that found that between 2000 and 2016, CMPD destroyed more than 1,000 sexual assault kits. That's on this week's FAQ City podcast, available right now on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/FAQ City. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Professor Scott Huffman, political science professor at Winthrop University and the director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory there, about the South Carolina primary, which is tomorrow. The two key races that we're talking about this morning are that in the Democratic and Republican primaries in the governor's race and also in the 5th Congressional District, which we'll get to in a moment. So 42% popularity, 46% overall popularity of President Trump among all citizens of South Carolina. So how difficult will it be for a Democrat? Because you got 80% of GOP voters there supporting Trump, probably 100% of Democratic voters opposing him, who knows. So are there more Democrats than Republicans in South Carolina? Yes. Are there, how many independents? Is it the independents who will make this decision in November?
Well, it's the independents and the Democrats, whether they turn out, because historically, it's a lot closer between Democrats and Republicans than people think. It's usually only about 4 or 5 points. But when it comes to turnout, there's a difference of 15 or more points. Republicans turn out in higher numbers. Now, that's been changing. African-American women turn out at incredibly high rates and have been changing races. In fact, they're the reason Barack Obama won the Democratic primary back in 2008 in South Carolina. So there have been those changes. Now it's gotten a little wider since Trump. The people who self-identify as Republican to Democrat, and the independents have grown, but true independents, I mean truly in the middle, they don't lean one way or another, that's usually only about 10% of the population, even though more than a third usually say, I'm an independent. So it is going to come down to turnout for them. The Democrat, any Democrat, absent Trump or not, enters into a gubernatorial race in South Carolina at a 10-point deficit. And the Democrats are hoping that lethargy among Trump supporters and not turning out and anger among Democratic supporters to turn out will make up that gap.
So you've got the incumbent governor on the Republican side of this with two candidates who are neck and neck, essentially, the next two candidates. Will there be a runoff in the Republican primary?
I don't see how there's not going to be a runoff. There will absolutely be a runoff on the Republican side. James Smith does have a chance on the Democratic side of winning it outright. You know, if you'd asked me 2 weeks ago, I'd have said fairly certainly it was going to be McMaster and Templeton in a runoff, but the Warren has surged so much in the last couple of weeks and has truly made himself the alternative to the insiders. Right. You know, that he may make it.
Okay. Let's move on to the 5th Congressional District. That's the other race of interest, I think, in our listening area. And that's where the GOP candidate, Ralph Norman, who's the incumbent, because he took over the seat of Mick Mulvaney when Mick Mulvaney went to the White House, is taking on Democrat Archie Parnell. This is a rematch. Norman barely beat Parnell in a special election to replace Mick Mulvaney. Both are running in their respective primaries again. So who are the other candidates? Are there other candidates?
Well, Norman doesn't have really anybody running against. There's a Democratic primary. And, you know, back to your point, they ran against each other before, and Norman, in very conservative Republican 5th District now, won by only 3% of the vote. And this was when the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, dumped a ton of money down in Georgia in the Ossoff race, and he lost hugely, and they didn't give as much money to Parnell, and he only lost by 3%. Says, okay, Parnell's going to take this. Well, there are other people in the race before we come back to Parnell. Parnell, of course, the Goldman Sachs guy. Mark Ali, describes himself as a former undocumented immigrant from Suriname. Then there's a real clown, Steve Lau, who is a actual real clown. He was with Ringling Brothers. Sidney Moore. He was sort of the you know, person that nobody heard of or talked about. He was on the York County Council for a while, but as people are leaving Archie Parnell, a lot of them are coming behind Sidney Moore, but yeah. Parnell's still got the name recognition.
So let's talk about why they're leaving Archie Parnell, because this guy maybe could have come into this race and won this time, but then maybe not. Has Norman distinguished himself in some way in Congress that people like?
Well, the Republicans
in Washington, I mean,
the Republicans, like, not really. He's signed on to a couple of pieces of legislation. Okay. He really potentially alienated a lot of, you know, suburban mom type voters. He met with Moms Demand Action, the pro gun control group, at a restaurant in Rock Hill, and this was after some of the school shootings. And in that meeting with these pro gun control folks, he whipped out his gun and laid it on the table in the restaurant. He was trying to make the point of, hey, if you had me and or somebody with a gun, you'd be protected. That really turned off a lot of voters. But, and perhaps the only other way to turn off female voters even more is to, I don't know, have the fact that you had beat your wife come out from the past, which is exactly what happened to Archie Parnell.
Yeah, evidently he admits, he confirmed the veracity of rumors that said in 1973 he physically beat the person who is now his ex-wife. What has been the impact of that revelation?
That has been huge, mainly because he told no one before he ran, and it seems the Republicans didn't even dig this up. It was first discovered.
How did it come out?
Yeah. We don't know who released it, but it was first discovered by internal opposition research by saying, okay, what could anybody possibly find out about our guy? They went and looked and found it, and his two top advisors quit on the base of that, because he had not revealed this before. They all knew he had a former wife, but not that he had, they were estranged. He broke down a door with a tire iron, went into the apartment, beat her and somebody else, and she had to get restraining orders against him. So that came out, and he's still got a core of supporters, obviously, but many of his supporters said, how could you have done this? The Cook Political Report had actually moved the race to leans Republican. Okay, now that's very pro-Democrat in the 5th District, right? It was solid. It moved to lean because Parnell had a chance. When this came out, they moved it back to certain Republican.
So that trumps, and there's no pun intended there, that trumps the laying of the gun at a meeting at a diner on the table.
Well, this is the Democratic primary, and so it's sort of, yes, you lied to us in this Me Too movement year. This matters, but Parnell supporters are saying exactly that. He's sorry about it. He's apologized. He now gets along with his ex-wife, I believe. He's the best chance to beat Norman. That's exactly what his supporters are saying.
And he is the best chance, correct?
Yeah, based on his – well, yes, because he's the best known and he can get the most money.
The other thing that came out of this Rock Hill diner with Ralph Norman laying his gun on the table, he didn't break any laws. He has a concealed carry permit.
He does.
The restaurant does not ban weapons, so he didn't break any rules in the restaurant either, but he gave a reason for carrying a gun, saying he wouldn't be a victim, they wouldn't be victims if he had a gun, and he would not be another Gabby Giffords, who is the congresswoman who was shot at a campaign rally at a shopping center, I think in Arizona, and who has had to leave Congress because of a mental disability as a result of that. That's not people don't cotton to that.
Yeah, it was extremely poor taste. At the minimum, it was really not thinking things through, because the fact is, when he's sitting there shaking hands with people in a meet and greet, mm-hmm. unless he literally is holding his pistol to their face,
that's right.
He could easily have been a Gabby Giffords, because this guy walked up while he was shaking your hands, gun out of nowhere, and fired. So it could be possible. But so that was, had not this Archie Parnell thing come out, that really would have moved a lot of women against Norman and behind Parnell. But now Parnell squandered that.
So let me get you to predict some things here. Who's going to win the Democratic 5th Congressional District primary?
Well, it would have been Archie Parnell outright. No runoff.
Okay.
He's still probably going to get the most votes. The question would be, who's the runoff? The undocumented immigrant, the clown. He is working clown. I'm not insulting the guy. He was a working clown for the circus, or Sidney Moore, who just minimally experienced but has been gaining support, not known that well. Whoever gets it, this is now almost certainly Norman's race.
So the working clown, and that's not meant to be a pejorative.
I think he may be retired. I'd have to go back and
he's
still
ask you what
juggles
he does now.
Amazing.
Really?
Yeah. He's got a video on his website. I'm just amazed by jugglers. It's fascinating because I can't do it.
Right.
But yeah, go to his website. He's a great juggler.
Scott Huffman is the director of the Winthrop Poll and also the founder and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop University. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Always my pleasure.
So, I mentioned that we would be speaking this hour with one of the most important people in Charlotte, and now is the time. April Johnson is the 2018 Teacher of the Year at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, and over the years, we've spoken to many of these award-winning educators, and I have to say, I have always been impressed by them, by their diligence, their dedication, their wisdom, and the aspirations they have, not for themselves, but for the students that they teach. April Johnson is an arts teacher at Tuckasegee Elementary who was taken off guard by this award and by the greeting she received from her students when she arrived on the morning of that announcement. I want to thank the Charlotte Observer for that audio. That April Johnson, welcome to the program. You didn't expect that kind of reception. I watched it. You were overcome with emotion.
I truly was. I mean, I did not expect that at all. We were at the Cracker Barrel, and my principal says, "Get here now." And so we're trying to wrap up my pancakes and get to the school. And I mean, we're listening to Justin Timberlake's that song. What is it? Can't Stop the Feeling. And as we're rolling up, the windows come down of my assistant principal's car, and that's when we see all the kids lined up, and it was amazing. I felt like a rock star. It was just, and then to hear my kids singing to me was just amazing. Especially a young lady who was leading the song, who at the beginning of the year had such a small voice. And now she leads the songs.
How do you explain that?
Love.
On your part toward her?
And encouragement from everybody. One of our media specialists is also a musician and works in music technology as a radio tech in his own right. And even he would be encouraging. Hey, have you sung today? Let's try it. And just to watch her voice expand, to watch her confidence expand this year, was a huge blessing.
So the celebration that greeted you the morning of that announcement was a surprise, was being named Teacher of the Year a surprise? Because you've been named Teacher of the Year. Evidently, CMS breaks down different educational areas
right
within the whole system and names Teachers of the Year. This is the first time you were Teacher of the Year for the whole system. Was that a surprise?
Yes. I formerly taught in Winston-Salem, so Teacher of the Year is done a little differently there.
Uh-huh.
And so here I won for my school, and then they were like, well, we have to go do the West Learning Community. And that covers all the schools that are on the West Side. And I went to an interview for that, and then I found out I won. And so that's on Facebook. You'll see Dr. Carroll, our superintendent for the West Side, surprising me with balloons and all these great things. And again, total shocker. I'm not blessed with time, so I was running late to a faculty meeting. And so my principal's at the door, and she's like, good, you made it in time. And I'm like, oh, okay, great. Because our school had also won a grant from a nonprofit called Real School Gardens. So I thought the meeting was about that. I thought, you know, that because we were having over 100 volunteers from AT&T come in that day. So I thought the big meeting was about the AT&T volunteers and everything, because the Glee Club, the ones you just heard singing,
right,
were to sing for the volunteers that day. So she has me standing up there in the meeting, and I was like, yes, the Glee Club's going to sing, and we're surprised, and it's going to be great. And out of nowhere, Dr. Carroll shows up with all these balloons and goes, let's hear it for the West Learning Community's Teacher of the Year. And I'm all, what? it was amazing.
Your story is an interesting one, because although your mom was a teacher, you tried very hard not to become one because you wanted to make some money.
I do remember telling her that.
Yeah, and you weren't a terribly good student at a certain point in your educational career, and yet you majored in education, you earned an arts education degree from Winston-Salem State, And lo and behold, you've become a teacher. Why?
Well, it's funny. I wanted to be a graphic design major.
Yeah.
Which is, I love the idea of doing that. I loved advertising. I love the way words and images come together to influence ideas. So I could talk about iconography and how that works all day. But what happened was that I honestly feel like the edge that is required and the business mind that's required with that, maybe I didn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And the professor and I didn't see eye to eye. And it's really funny because you can't get away from who you are. I had been tutoring people the whole time I was in school because I had earned a scholarship. And people were like, man, you're really good at that. Are you going to major in education? Nah, I'm not majoring in education. But you can't get away from who you are. And I think the turning point for me came when I started volunteering at Upward Bound, which is a program to help high school students bridge into college. It's a very, very important program, particularly for students of color. And so it was like it just came together for me. I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. This battle with my professor, and I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and try this. I'll take a couple classes, see what happens, and it clicked.
With everything we hear about public education today, about what is being demanded of teachers and public schools in general by parents and politicians and people like that, when we hear about low pay and long hours and insufficient support, when we have teachers around the country marching on legislatures, as our teachers did in this state for one day, because pay is low, respect is low, pressure is high, you're graded on how students perform, something over which you have limited control, because mm-hmm. a lot of these kids come from terrible family situations or neighborhood situations where performance in school is the least of their worries. What is the motivating factor for a person like you to become a teacher?
To teach is to save a life. I had a lot of people midwife me into where I am right now. You know, I feel like to watch someone kick and squirm and figure it out is an honor and a privilege, because you have this hope, you have this expectation that who they're going to be on the other side is so worth it and so valuable. You have to have a different kind of perspective to become a teacher. You have to be willing to share of yourself. And just like I mentioned earlier this year, you know, to watch this young lady have a small voice mm-hmm. that grew into a big voice, amazing. And I got to watch that, to watch a young man who we teased him and called him Linus all year, again, grow into his confidence. It was just amazing. So to teach is to save a life and to change one.
We'll talk more about that with April Johnson, the CMS 2018 Teacher of the Year, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest for the remainder of the program is April Johnson, an arts teacher at Tuckasegee Elementary, Teacher of the Year for CMS, a former student at Tuckasegee Elementary.
Yes.
What was it like to go back there? And I think you were at Tuckasegee, what, fourth, fifth grade?
Yes.
So that was before you became not such a good student.
Right.
So you probably had a decent experience at Tuckasegee. What was it like going back there as a teacher?
It was crazy because it doesn't look anything like, of course, as I remember it as a child. And the very art room where I teach was the former kitchen of the cafeteria, because the floor is tiled a certain way. And I looked down and I was like, this must have been the kitchen. Mm. So where I teach art was formerly the kitchen. And so, but yet nothing looks the same. But I was just like, wow. But I think I'm one of the few people on the staff that actually remembers the old Tuckasegee.
Wow.
And so I feel like I bring an energy that wants to see that sense of Tuckasegee come back. I picked up my first instrument there. I learned to play chess there. Things that have seriously changed my life and impacted my life. And so to come back to a Tuckasegee that didn't do those things was bananas. And so, but with some of those things have come back. Our chess club has come back mm-hmm. and pretty strong. But, you know, as a whole, CMS doesn't teach instruments in fourth and fifth grade anymore, which I find a shame.
You mean music?
Yes.
And I was actually surprised that they teach art, to be honest with you. And you said that in your own personal life and as a student growing up, art saved you.
How so?
My
9th grade year, I struggled socially, emotionally with the transition to high school. And that led me to skipping school a lot and trying to figure out where I wanted to be. And so my mother opted for a alternative school. And at that time, all the alternative schools here in Charlotte were hidden inside churches. So you could drive by one every day and not know there was a school in there. It was right down the street, the big church right down the street from Discovery Place, held Wesley Alternative High School. And that's where I went to school every day for the latter half of my 9th grade year. And they had an art room in there, as unmanned art room. And we could go in there and throw paint and, you know, and just vibe. And what happened was my splashes started to come together and the colors started to, and I was like, whoa, I might be good at this. And I remember showing my paintings to my mom shortly after. I also entered auditioned for a theater troupe called Heart to Heart, which was sponsored by the Children's Theater. And I was like, okay, this feels good. So I'm painting at home. My mom bought me my first easel. And I'm going to theater practice. And it was like that began to turn me around. I belonged to something. I was connected to something. And that felt really good. And shortly after that, I auditioned for Northwest.
School of the Arts.
School of the Arts, right over there on Beatty's Ford. So, yes. And I came into Northwest around 97. And I graduated in 99 from there.
You're a baby.
Yeah. Yep. I'm the third graduating class of Northwest.
You mentioned that they don't teach music in the fourth and fifth grade at CMS anymore. And there has been a diminishing of arts education around the country. At least that's the impression that most people have. And an emphasis on STEM education, mm-hmm. because that's where business needs people who understand math and who understand science. But as a result of that, for some reason, we cut back on arts because we can't have both, because we can't afford both. What do you see as the importance of arts and an arts education, whether you learn a musical instrument or you learn to paint or sculpt or whether you learn to act? What's the importance of that to society?
Well, first of all, we have, if you Google it, we have what's called 21st century skills. A group of business people spoke to educators and said, these are the skills we need young workers to have. Mm-hmm. And in the 21st century skills, one of them is the ability to present ideas, the ability to collaborate with others. And the arts are very big a part of that. To be able to present ideas and to collaborate is a huge part of that. Because, I mean, whether you're 5 years old holding up a picture going, this is what I made, or whether you're in a team full of people putting on a play, you're learning to present ideas and collaborate. You're also learning to problem solve. When I give children a bag of popsicle sticks, because it's not just STEM, it's STEAM. We are the A in STEAM. If I give a children a popsicle sticks and I say, make me a sculpture, and I say, make it 3 feet high, make it freestanding where it can't touch the table, can't be attached to the table, now we're problem solving, which is another 21st century skill that students have to be able to have. And compound that with research skills, that's important. So kids can go, well, I don't know, what kind of structure should we use? What kind of shape should we use? Well, let me research it. And they're not just going to Google to find the answer, but they're looking and trying out different ideas. And so all of those things. So the arts definitely breed 21st century skills. They also equalize things for a lot of students. I have a young lady who didn't speak any English, but when she comes to art, she's just fine. And she's just like her peers.
It's a universal language.
It is. It's a universal language. Even for my students who are special needs, they get to come in and be just like everyone else and on equal footing with everyone else. So, and it does not matter if I have to give you a thicker paintbrush or a special pair of scissors to do so. You're still on equal footing with your peers.
When you were talking earlier about arts and finding yourself, and mm-hmm. the fact that art saved you, I think kids growing up have to find out who they are and what turns them on. And if they don't find that, going to school, particularly if you don't do well academically, can be a truly miserable experience, a self-deflating experience, one where you don't think you're good at anything and therefore not good enough for anything. Mm-hmm. You find, whether it's in art or football or whatever, you have to give them opportunities to find out where they excel. Mm-hmm. When you take away art or arts education in general, music, whatever it may be, what are we doing to those kids? If they're not athletically inclined, if they don't want to be part of student government, but they might find themselves behind an easel someday, excelling. If that's not there, what do we do to those kids?
Well, then you've taken a piece of their future away. You're taking a chance, because even just the exposure to arts can create a hunger or lead children down a rabbit trail. It was really funny. I've never expected to receive fan mail as a result of this honor, and I received a letter from the Taylorsville Correctional Institute. A guy wrote me a letter, and he said he saw my article, and it was just this very heartfelt letter about how he too felt like a misfit. Mm. And that he wished that he had ran out, you know, that he had encountered a teacher like myself, but that he was just glad to know that, you know, that there was someone out there looking out for the misfits.
Teachers can change lives, and they most often probably are not told how they've changed the student's life, because it doesn't go verbalized. It just, and sometimes the student probably doesn't even realize it until 5 or 6 or 10 or even 20 or 30 years later what that person did for them. My English teacher in sophomore year in high school changed my life, because she, and I've told this story on the air before, because she, we had to do a book report. And when we wrote it as a class, she turned it back in. We all got F's. So she said, "You're going to do it again. And here's what's wrong. Now do it again." And we did it again, and we all got F's or D's. And she said, "Okay, it's clear to me you can't write." So because we're studying English literature and American literature this semester, we're not going to do any of that. We're going to diagram sentences. Spent the whole semester diagramming sentences. Now, that sounds awful, and it was. But by gosh, I can write. In a video you produced, or produced about you by the Charlotte Observer, you talk about trying to learn every student in the school's name and about trying to build relationships with kids. You're trying to be a role modeler, a counselor, a teacher, somebody to talk to for these young people. Is that what you signed up for? Is that all part of being a teacher?
Yes. Yes, it is. I watched my mother do the same things. My mom was a teacher for 28 and a half years, and I watched her care about those kids. I watched her come home and tell stories about her kids. And so I knew that signing on meant that we were going to care about kids, but I didn't know, even listening to my mom's stories growing up, the depth of love that it requires to be a teacher. Mm. I have a young man, he would come in every day this year, and I'd, "Do you have a pencil?" "No, ma'am." "Well, come here, let me brush your hair." And and I would fix his uniform collar, and I'd say, "Now you're looking good. Here's your pencil. Let's go. Let's go start your day." It just, those little things like that mean something, to be seen, to be noticed. Because some of my kids,
to be cared about.
Exactly. Exactly. A lot of my parents are not bad parents at the school. They're doing the best they can with what they have. And so sometimes, you know, it makes it difficult. And so understanding that it takes a village, that, you know, a village helped raise me, and now it's my turn to be part of the village to help raise someone else, is a profound responsibility, and yet it is an honor.
What grade do you teach?
Well, I teach kindergarten through fifth, but I'm certified to teach up through high school.
You know, I've noticed, because I used to do a lot of reading to kids in school, that if you read to a first or second or third grader, there's a light in their eyes. And if you come back in the fourth or fifth grade and do something with these kids, sometimes that light has gone out. Not in every kid, but in a lot of children, you can just see they're dead. Their eyes are dead. And that means mm-hmm. they're not having a good experience in school. What happens to those kids where the light goes out? What happens?
It's usually because they can't transition because of a basic skill deficit sometimes. Sometimes they can't transition to the next level because they lack the confidence. And again, developmentally in psychology, we talk about Erickson's stages of development. And so there's a stage of development called skill acquisition, and it happens right around 7, 8, 9. And when a child can't get the skill acquisitions that their peers are getting, that's when we start to see that confidence drop off. That's when we begin to see that not care look, that dead eye look.
So how do you help them?
Well, that's when we make a team of support around them to help them get those skill acquisitions. So if it's, I don't have any friends, well, we try to set up, particularly in elementary school, not so much middle and high, but particularly in elementary school, we try to set up ways for them to make friends. If it's that I'm still not reading the way I should be, well, we have all manner of programs within the school to do that. We give away books. Our school library purges our catalog every 3 to 6 months, and we just give books away. The other thing we do to help them with reading is we have the AmeriCorps partnered with a nonprofit group this year called Reading Partners. And Reading Partners pulls kids and helps them with their skill acquisition. Mm-hmm. And so that's a huge thing. And, of course, we beg for community volunteers to come in and read with children, because not being able to read, and I think the other big skill acquisition is the multiplication tables. If you do not know your multiplication tables with a sense of proficiency, you cannot cross over into the next level of math.
Multiplication tables came up on Friday's program because as a person in the legislature trying to mandate that those multiplication tables are part of the curriculum in public schools in North Carolina, along with cursive writing. How important is cursive writing in your opinion?
It's everything, because some kids, I can't read their writing. as it stands right now, the only cursive you have to know is to be able to sign your name. Mm-hmm. So that's problematic. We were just talking about it, some friends of ours were talking about it, because in this current political climate, even the original documents that detail our rights and responsibilities as citizens are in cursive. And so if you can't read cursive, you just have to take for someone else's word what it says. And that stifles you for being a citizen in the now. So think about that, because our children are not citizens for the future. They are citizens of the now. And if you can't read those documents.
Let's talk about that, because you mentioned in one of the articles I read about you something I'd never heard a teacher say. And it has to do with kids being ahistorical beings because they're young and they don't know a lot about what came before them. So they have to be given an understanding of what came before so that they can understand the now. How do you do that without injecting politics?
That is a very hard time. And what we do is we say, let me tell you a story. And then and I think that's a big part of it, because if they can understand, a lot of children, like to be told stories. Mm-hmm. And so telling the stories is a big part of it. We'll look at an art piece, for example. It was this piece about people voting. Mm-hmm. And I will talk to them and I will say, well, what do you notice strange about this picture? I wish I could remember the art piece right now. And they were like, well, where are all the women? And I said, well, sweetie, women couldn't vote yet. And now every little girl in that room is like, well, what do you mean women couldn't vote? And I was like, well, see, this is what I mean. And, you know, and then I said, what else do you notice about this picture? And they were like, well, where are all the brown people? Well, brown people couldn't vote yet either. And now you have first and second graders up in arms because they're like, well, why? And children have a profound sense of justice. And, you know, until you're nine, nothing is fair. And so you begin to tell the stories that way and understand, you know, and helping them understand that, you know, the community had to vote on laws to change the situation. And they go, wow. And I mean, like, for example, just little things like that. Like, you know, I remember as a child, one of the, you know, to be old enough to get a Susan B. Anthony dollar. And my children have never seen one. They don't even know who Susan B. Anthony is. Whereas I remember getting that as like a reward for a good report card or something.
Right.
They've never seen one.
Right.
They didn't even, like, I have to tell the stories of who's on each piece of money even. Because they know what the money is and they know what it's worth. But to know this president is on this money and... And so, like, we have, like, to put markers, like, this was before Walmart. This was before Dr. King. This was before, and putting things in situations like that, like, this was before color TV.
What? Wait, there's a world before color TV?
Oh, man. We lost, like, 15 minutes of class just on that.
I have to stop this.
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm so sorry, because I have so many more questions for you, because you're not only just an arts teacher, you're not only an arts teacher, you are a thinker, a deep thinker, which is where most great teachers are. April Johnson, 2018 CMS Teacher of the Year, arts teacher at Tuckasegee Elementary. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.